Today, novelist Bernie Shine. It's kind of funny to say novelist Bernie Shine because, I don't know, for about 40 years or so, Bernie Shine was a infamous teacher for the greatest length of time in his career at the Paideia School here in Atlanta. And I will confess that one of my kids had Bernie in seventh grade and still hasn't recovered. Bernie Shine, thanks for being on the show. You did it, man. You wrote a novel. You spent all those years teaching literature, and now they're going to have to teach you.
Yeah, I hope they will. I mean, but yes, it was dying to come out.
So I mean, have you been writing this your whole life, or tell me?
I think so. I was always either writing about education and school and kids and so forth, or writing about the Jewish Southerner. So,
which you happen to be.
Which I happen to be. I grew up in Beaufort, South Carolina, in the Low Country. My family has been there since 1896. And my grandfather started off as a peddler. We actually had a large proportion of Jewish families because Charleston and Savannah, two of the oldest synagogues in America, we're right between them on the coast. Beautiful. Beaufort's a beautiful town.
By all accounts, and I'm sorry to say I haven't been there, and I'll try to change that. Okay, but really important question. As a Jew in Low Country, can you eat the Low Country boil, which is heavy on shellfish? And that, did you as a child?
That is what's called the Jew in the Low Country. That's assimilation, and absolutely. Now, that line of demarcation was clear. The Southerner comes out. Where we were different, where there was no Evan Rood in a Jewish driveway, you know.
You didn't see motorboat.
Yeah, you didn't see Jewish fathers under the hoods of their automobiles on Saturday afternoons with their kids. There were hardly any Jewish baseball coaches. No deer antlers on walls. It was different in that way.
And of course, well, I should say, you know, your novel, your first novel, not your first book, but your first novel is called Famous All Over Town. There's obviously a ton of autobiographical stuff in here. And in fact, Shine's Grocery Store makes an appearance,
yep.
which was where you grew up.
That's right. I grew up thinking that until I went to school, and this is a time of complete segregation, but I grew up thinking that black people were better than white people until I got to school. And that's because I grew up basically in my father's store on Bladen Street, which bordered the slums. The people who came in were mostly blacks, mostly poor, not always, but mostly poor. And they were polite. They were friendly. And it was the poorest of black people who gave this five-year-old boy a nickel back in the 50s, which was a lot of money for a little boy back in the 50s. And the whites who came in, they were nice, but they were mostly drunks. And, you know, they would get breakfast, take it to the counter, open a can of sardines, put it on saltine crackers, and chase it with Blue Ribbon beer.
Now, yum.
Yeah. Mm. And, of course, and my mom was a classical pianist. She used to raise money for the UJA and for Israel back then and so forth. So she was totally turned off by all this. Daddy could have cared less. I could have cared less. So that's where I grew up. And those people were very kind to me. And because of my dad, race became a very important part of me. They were like inside me. Their voices needed to speak out as much as the Jewish Southerner. Who was the gay person back then in Beaufort? You know, what was he going through? It was a military town, the war heroes, the war criminals.
And all of this comes through in Famous All Over Town. I mean, you said this book was always there, but what are you trying to say?
The title suggests that when you're famous all over town, it means everybody knew each other. Everybody was either famous or infamous. You knew that when the mayor's the Lincoln Continental, black one, was parked behind the library in Shrubbery in the middle of the night, what was going on? The drunken cab driver, there was only one, Dacus. We'd play baseball in the street. There were no shopping centers. It was quiet. Not much traffic. And, you know, you knew when the cab driver was coming down the street to get the hell out of the way. Nobody thought anything about it. You knew, and you did. It's like Daddy said, anybody short-circuited enough to be on the road when that guy's careening down there ought to be run over.
But my question was, what's your message in this book? What's the story
the
you want
is,
people to know?
We knew each other, and there was an intimacy. And most things didn't have to be said, and in the South, that's the way it was, unless you were a Jew. What we didn't know about each other was even more powerful. And so even though everybody was famous or infamous, and there was an implied intimacy, what we know now in retrospect and in hindsight is frankly, abuse wasn't in the lexicon then, and it was a military town. So you're talking about, you know, 25-30% of the kids being abused. Nobody knew. I didn't know what was going on in Pat Conroy's house. I didn't know that my best friend's mother was suicidal and would end up killing herself. We didn't know all the machinations and all the psychological and sociological and political manifestations that were going on then. And now, of course, they have come out. Buford has gone from redneck to resort. You couldn't find a New York Times was banned in the high school, David, when I was a kid. Now it's in every fifth driveway. So things have changed. And what I'm trying to say in the book, I think, are two things. One, blacks, whites, gays, straights, journalists, politicians, Episcopalians, everybody, swindlers, prostitutes, everybody has a voice. Everybody has a say in here. But it is inevitably from the perspective of a Jewish Southerner. And it's a small town Jewish Southerner. I was being interviewed by a Times reporter. She was shocked, she admitted, that there was even a Jew who lived in South Carolina. Okay? Certainly, the Low Country. When I went to Harvard and I had my first interview, the guy looks at the paper, they looked at my record and said, how can you people let that kind of racism go on down there? I just driven through Roxbury listening to a diatribe from a cab driver.
Nothing quite like Northern hypocrisy.
All right.
And,
so then,
and lack of understanding.
Right. And this is not to deny the institutionalized racism that was in the South, but there was something personal and intimate there.
I would argue with your comment that people didn't know each other. I would say that white folks didn't know black folks, but that the reverse was not true, because I think black folks had to know white folks in order to survive, and that they studied white folks and that they understood white folks and, you know, in a way that white folks are oblivious to black life.
That's a great comment. There's no question about it. You know, yeah, you knew who was who and what to expect from who, whether you were white or black. But let's face it, blacks knew us way better than we knew
them.
And there's no question about that.
All right. So you know, there are several characters, obviously, I love in this book. I mean, many of them. It's a very, very funny book. I should repeat the title, Famous All Over Town, by my guest novelist, Bernie Shine. There's the Southern Jew, a.k.a. Bernie, you know, Murray Gold, the lawyer sort of character. There's the Northern Jew, who's moved down to the South.
He's based on David Lewis.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
he is.
He's way too well-balanced for that. But I love the character of the Madame.
Oh, I do too. Lila Truelove.
She, to me, is the Madame is the conscience of this book. Tell me about Lila Truelove. And she, is she a real person? I mean, is she based on a real person?
She is. She's based on my hero when I was a school principal and teaching in Buford. Strikingly beautiful, just like Lila in the book physically. Only this woman was a teacher. You know, she gave it all away. We had the first black studies program down there, and she would come in and talk to the, she was a first grade teacher, come in and talk to the sixth graders. She'd hear this racist venom these kids had from their father, and she would listen like everything they were saying was the most important thing in the world. And they would follow her out. It was like the Pied Piper. The board was stalling on desegregation. In a room of 350 people, she's a teacher. She stands up and she said, look, if a teacher is not doing her job, she's either fired or she's asked to resign. I move that the board resign. She gave it all away. Now, here's the problem. I'm dealing with a whole town. And even though there's a Southern Jewish perspective, the town is the central character. So it can't be just a teacher. And I thought to myself, if there's no honest person in this town, black or white, there can't be. If you're black, you certainly can't be. You can know, but you can't say. And if you're white, you can't even know. You're in denial. You grow fat on it.
Right.
All right? So
things are set up so that you do grow fat on it.
Exactly. And so the question is, who would have that? And, of course, it would be the owner, the Madame of the brothel, which was based on the Ritz Cafe, the only unkempt place downtown at the time. Dirty screen doors, rusty and so forth. And I remember my parents. The parents wouldn't let you. They didn't want you near it. And we thought when we were little that witches come out on brooms or something. So I put her there. Why? Because if she was going to be an honest woman in town, she had to have an extraordinary power. And her place, David, was the only institution in town that white men entered through the back door.
Right.
And they were prominent. She had their names. She knew who they were. She could say anything she wanted. And she had only one interest, her children. Mm-hmm. I want money for my children. And she didn't want to teach school, which was the only thing a black woman could do back then, you know.
Right, right.
So Lila True Love is based, ironically enough, on my idol, who was a hero and a very intimate friend of mine. And, of course, I don't want to say who that is only because I have made her the madame of a brothel. And if you don't know the story, it would cheapen her.
Yeah. So define the Jewish Southerner.
Ah, that's good. Well, like most Jews, you would differentiate him from the Gentile because all the Gentiles knew where the fuse box was. Yeah, they had names like Kick and, I mean, Bill and Biff and Bruce, you know, and Tom. Well, who were we? Morty and Marvin and Melvin and Mervin and Bernie, for God's sakes. Do you know? And hardly matinee idol names. We were different in that way. Certainly, there was almost no anti-Semitism. Okay, this is a surprise for a lot of people, but the local small town Jews in the South will tell you this very little. Now, as Morris Abrams said, if we'd walked down the street dressed like hostages, it might have been different. I would also say this. There was a guy named Josie Lipschitz who owned the big department store downtown. And when the Klan was marching in the late 60s, and the Klan was pretty tame in Beaufort, up the road it was much worse, a few miles. They were dressed and you couldn't see them in their robes and so forth. The people were worried, so they brought in cops from Charleston, police chief. And Josie's standing there, and he sold them their shoes. So he can identify their names and makes a list and gives it to the police chief of who the Klan members actually are under those masks and robes. Well, Josie was also friends with a redneck, dumb guy named Earl Bessinger. And Josie, they you know, have a drink together, whatever. So Josie goes over to Earl's house one night about 6:30. And Earl comes out of the door, and he's humiliated. He's embarrassed. And he, big guy, you know, he says, gosh, Josie, I'm so sorry. This is embarrassing, but I can't invite you in. We're having a Klan meeting. So Josie says, no problem, Earl. I just wanted to let you know I got a sale on sheets. I think in a way that was what it was like. And remember, too, that the lack of anti-Semitism, it's like I don't remember if I said it, if my daddy said, if it weren't for the blacks, it probably would have been the Jews.
Right. You did eventually make it to Harvard, of course, and you used that like you know, that was for the School of Education, I believe, right?
Yeah, the graduate school, yeah.
Graduate School of Education. And you know, it seems like you used just about every part of your life, although I don't see a lot of Paideia in this book where you taught for all those years.
Well, actually, what I've been told by a few people who teach at Paideia now is Paideia is in this book. Now, you're right. Nobody would know it.
Not obviously.
No, but the stuff I learned working with adults and kids at Paideia.
Yes, yes.
Certainly.
No, yeah.
You know,
the classroom scenes and obviously, you know, the psychology of kids and so on. That is very
the Marine?
Yeah.
I mean, when I would work with adults in creative writing, there were three or four multiple personalities I'd do in the evenings when I was here.
Well, you'd fit in perfectly.
Exactly. So. They thought I was one, too. We got together.
Well, we've actually talked very little bit about the book. I mean, you know, it has all these underlying themes of the battle between black and white, the outsider, the Jew, the observer, the military. But you know, what are the main pillars of the story? And I think it, you know, relates to the trials of Jack McGowan and
yeah,
and so
I think probably the child driver True Love, who is the offspring of the sheriff and his mistress. Lila True Love, the madam of the brothel, and Elizabeth, Lila's daughter from her first marriage, her resentment and her hatred of this white sheriff and what she perceives he did to her mother. That story runs throughout the book, the integration of the school, fitting in. She becomes the valedictorian. And of course, this was during the time of civil rights, but it was also during the time of Vietnam.
Right.
And my first acquaintance of death was when I was 12. And That's when you saw, for the first time, strangers coming to town. We'd never seen strangers in town. This guy on the front, I'm sure, is either a Washington Post or a New York Times reporter. Jack, at that time, a guy named Matthew McKeon in 1956 marched his platoon, recruits, into Ribbon Creek off Parris Island, and some of them drowned. The character here is not Matthew McKeon. Matthew McKeon was a good man who made an awful, awful tragic error. But we both know, because of what we know now that was going on back then, because what we know that was going on back then, let's face it, there was a whole lot going on with people who were not good people. And who would this person have been, looking back on it, that could have marched 71 18-year-old boys into this swamp, into the tidal basin with a riptide, knowing some of them couldn't swim? And of course, that would be a product of a man who's been treated awfully.
Yeah, and then this, you know, the scenes with the psychiatrist and the, you know, the hypnosis or whatever mm-hmm. it is, and yeah, those are great. I mean, and it pops up, you know, mm-hmm. in several occasions throughout the book. You have a wonderful moment when someone talks about how proud they are that their father has read these two books, one being the Bible and one the FBI story
by J. Edgar Hoover. That's right.
And I guess you probably knew kids like that.
Absolutely, and that was Hoke Cooley. That's the sheriff in the book. I've had people tell me, David, that they really like him. And it must be the complexity of what it meant to be white in a legally segregated place where, you know, he was the one who fed the poor.
Well, you know, in that old civil rights mantra of deeds, not words, his words were awful but in the book, but his deeds are different.
Yes. And his deeds are both. In a big way, his deeds are good, but he doesn't want Lila buying into downtown.
Right. He has lines, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Tell me, the book is obviously Pat Conroy is a lifelong friend. You grew up with him. You appear as a character in his books. Tell me about Pat's role as a mentor to an aspiring novelist and what his role was in helping you with the book.
Well, I have Pat in here as the town pervert because it's all about... No, it's a joke. But no, Pat and I are old buddies, and believe me, he'd be saying that about me if he were in here. He has been dying for me to write this book for I don't know how long. And when somebody said, what inspired the character of the war hero, the war criminal, McGowan, Royal Cunningham, particularly Jack McGowan, the drill sergeant, I have to tell you that Pat is a large, is an initial inspiration for that. Basically, I didn't believe Pat when he used to talk about his father. Everybody
the
grows,
great Santini.
Yeah,
yes.
Everybody grows up thinking their family is like everybody else's. And Pat, of course, wasn't that forthcoming. But I've always
He's
thought
not
he,
Jewish.
Yeah, and I always thought he was exaggerating. So he gives me a draft of the Great Santini to read because before he sends it off, he just wants me to go through it because I'm such a genius, right? So what happens is
think what that book could have been if someone else.
Well,
had
exactly. I know, poor guy. Yeah, and so what happens is I'm reading through it and I see a part that is just fanatically crossed out. Now remember, I'm a writer, but I'm a teacher. And teaching means everything to me. And what you look for when you're teaching is what's not said. That's where the story is always going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I couldn't help it. You know, I'm nosy, and I deciphered it. Now, in that scene, instead of when his father passes out on the point on the green in Beaufort, and he generously helps him up, takes him home. No. When his father's passed out, this 18-year-old boy named Ben Meacham pummels him to a pulp. And it is the angriest scene I have ever read in my life. And I realized then what had been going on. And Pat came over. We'd have a session, you know. I said, Pat, leave it in. It's great. Leave it in. It's the truth. Nobody will doubt it. And he said, nobody will believe it, Bernie. They won't understand. I can't. Well, that may have been true then, but they do now. And I think the reason is Pat Conroy in large part. And also, I'm hearing stuff from my kids at Padilla, and now I know what to do. I'm seeing shame I don't understand, guilt, anger I don't understand. I brought him straight over there, and he was beautiful, David. I mean, they opened up to him. There was a kid that was had a dad for a chemist or a biologist or something, and he'd always just fall short of excellent. I never could understand. And Pat looks at him and says, "Hey, Timmy, he won't beat you for A minuses, will he?" And Timmy just grins from ear to ear. He was passive-aggressively trying to get back and didn't even know he was doing it. But Pat was beautiful, and it opened it up, the entire world of abuse, and that would be John McGowan.
So you know, how much of this did you write before you showed any to Pat?
I didn't show any of it to Pat. His wife, Sandra Conroy, the novelist, and Janice Owens were two readers who were very helpful. The problem I had, frankly, was that I knew I had to cut 250 pages.
Yeah.
Okay, because it was just too nobody's going to read that now. And a lot of the advice from different people was, why don't you get this subplot? And I would say, I can't. They're connected because it's a town. And I said, can you just tell me what's boring? And I can cross it out. What stops you? I can just delete it. I have no trouble cutting. And there was a little problem there. Not that they couldn't find anything boring, I'm sure, but there was a problem. Jonathan Haupt is a guy Pat discovered, and he's a genius. And he is the editor of Story River Books. That's the only reason Pat started this press with his imprint. I sent it to Jonathan Haupt, who Pat had introduced me to. Sandra had introduced, his wife introduced me to. And Jonathan Haupt emailed me back, and he said, this book is about, certainly, the Jewish Southerner. It is about gays, straights, blacks, like I've said, everybody. But your central character, Bernie, is the town. It's the town of Somerset, South Carolina, based on Beaufort. You cut only anything that is not related to the town. I cut 250 pages in 3 days. The guy is a genius. I've seen him with other people. And that's why Pat started this, because he knows no good literature is going to come out of the traditional publishing companies anymore. They're going to stay in the warehouse for 1,000 years. Anthony Doerr's book made it through, which is great, but it's an exception.
Well, there's many stories there, like Lisa Genova about Alice, the film that just won Julianne Moore her Golden Globe. That was a book that was a self-published book because no publisher wanted it. And then it went on the bestseller list, of course. I just want to say, Bernie, obviously this book is a love letter to Beaufort.
It is.
And that is who you are, that town.
Yeah.
And you now live there again after 40 years being away.
And so, I must tell you that you know how I felt, because we were doing things together then. And I loved the idea of going home. I was ready. And of course, I missed the place. It was me. And I love it there, the politics, everything. And you were adored in that town by an entire congregation of Jews, because probably the 50s, post-Holocaust, there weren't many of us. But the town, too, they liked personalities.
Well, there's a couple of places in South Carolina where you can get away with having a personality, Charleston being the other one.
Well, yes, you can. But let me tell you, that's more recent. Charleston, when we were growing up, Charleston was not Beaufort. Charleston was the snobbiest town I've ever known in my life. It had a heart of pure rust. I mean, you lived on South Abroad. You lived on one block and you snubbed the people on the next one. So that has changed, because now, instead of in those society houses, you have gays from New York. You know, the ones with the power and the money are often the new people, and they keep it great.
Yeah. Well, Bernie, thank you so much for your time. And, again, I hope you sell a bazillion books. And
thank you,
David. Evan Rude in the driveway.
You know, I'm going to take your butt fishing.
Oh,
okay?
I actually like fishing. I guess I'm not a Southern Jew.
It means you're a sellout.
Yeah, I'm not a Southern Jew. That's all there is to it. Okay, Bernie, man, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, David. It's good to see you.
It's no problem. I don't have to be in Woodstock till
5:05. Okay. My guest is Bernie Schein. He's written a novel. It's called Famous All Over Town. Bernie Schein is my guest, a teacher at the Paideia School here in Atlanta for way too long, 35 or so years, I would imagine. And he's written a novel. It's called Famous All Over Town. Tomorrow, continue my conversation with Bernie Schein about his novel, Famous All Over Town. Today, continuing my conversation with novelist Bernie Schein, talking about his new book, Famous All Over Town. Schein, of course, was a teacher at the Paideia School in the middle school there for many, many years, more than 30, 35 years. He's written a nonfiction book, If Halden Caulfield Was in My Classroom, and he was a guest on the show for that. And now he's got his first novel, as I said, famous all over town. Continuing that conversation. Let's see, what was the natural? That'll do it. That should do it. Bernie Shine is my guest, talking about his novel, Famous All Over Town.